Hi, I'm David Ross, and welcome to episode 5 of The Sun's new podcast, Israel's War on Terror. This week, The Sun's senior reporter Paul Sims and our photographer Dan Charity spent a day embedded with the IDF in Gaza. That explosion you just heard was the sound of Israeli troops blowing up a missile dump. It was hidden in plain sight by Hamas terror chiefs on the golden sands of a Gaza beach. But as Paul explained, that was just one part of a mind-blowing day on the front line with the Israeli Defense Forces.
So we ended up heading down towards a military base on the border with Gaza. We arrived, met with members of the Israeli Defense Force. We were then taken through a number of checkpoints and met up with a unit who took us on the back of a Humvee and through towards Gaza. It's hard to describe, I'll do my best. You end up driving towards Gaza and there's a huge section of fence that is essentially the border, and it's cut open. So we drove through and we entered Gaza. You don't initially see a huge amount. You can see Gaza in distance, but at that stage, it's just a barren wasteland. There are various Israeli troops who have set up. Best way to describe it is positions. They're armed to the teeth, but they've set up positions. When we were in the Humvee, we were driving towards Gaza, and they explained that they'd actually had to create their own road into Gaza because the tracks that were previously there had been heavily booby-trapped by Hamas. So they've created this road of their own. So we then headed in towards northern Gaza, and it immediately becomes very, very clear that it's being razed to the ground. It's like, it's apocalyptic. It's like nothing I've really seen before. So we then get to a rendezvous point where we meet Major Mayan Muller, who's in charge of this tank division that we were with. So we transferred from the Humvee onto a Puma battle tank. And from there, that battle tank goes into the heart of northern Gaza. It's a place called Sharti, which is, it's an extraordinary thing. It's on the coast. It overlooks the sea, it overlooks the Mediterranean. But the further you go in, the buildings that were once there, I mean, it is like a seaside resort town, or was at the moment, certainly after the aerial bombardment from the Israeli Defense Forces and the troops going in. It looks like somewhere where there has been a nuclear fallout. The buildings are stripped back to their concrete foundations. There is rubble as far as the eye can see, twisted metal. The main high road into northern Gaza, into Sharti, you make out the central reservation, but only just. I mean, it's just debris absolutely everywhere. So we joined this, we joined the tank division we were taken in. There are Israeli troops all over the place. There are tanks going backwards and forwards. This like 4x4 snatch type vehicles. When we were in the tank, we could see lots of troops milling about, going from each property. All the properties are completely destroyed, but what they are looking for, desperately looking for, are the tunnels. It was explained to me in quite a huge amount of detail that the Hamas fighters had managed to make their way to the border completely undetected because they travelled underground through this complex labyrinth of tunnels that had popped them out just before the fence that is essentially the border between Gaza and Israel. And they, you know, came out of this tunnel, cut through the fencing, and launched their horrific massacre on October the 7th.
And whilst you were there, what did the IDF find? What did they show you?
So when we were there, you were on a coastal road, and they took us down towards the beach. And immediately, it doesn't look like a beach. You can see the Mediterranean, but you can't really make out a beach because there is just rubble absolutely everywhere. So they then took us a bit further down. They said, look around you. This is a beach. And you get a bit further on and you can see that there's a beach. There are parasols, there are sunbeds. It's clearly speech that is being used by the local populace. The civilians who live in their local neighborhoods have gone down there to swim and bathe and just, you know, relax on a Sunday. What was striking, though, is that they then led us only a couple of meters away to a shipping container that contained 20 missiles. These warheads have a range of between 150 and 200 kilometers. And you could see the cones of the warheads just poking out from the compartments that they were in. There were five columns, four rows, and the IDF were hooking these missiles up to red wire and to explosives. They packed it with 20 kilograms of explosives. And they explained while we were there that what Hamas does is places its weaponry within civilian positions. So they use the locals, the residents, the neighborhood as human shield. So this, it's unbelievable, really, that this shipping container is there on the beach, hiding in plain sight. And inside it, unbeknownst to the local populace, there are 20 missiles that Hamas are stockpiling. So they rigged it up with this red wire. The red wire trailed away to a detonator. We got back on the tank. We moved back at about 100 meters or so, not too far, but a safe distance enough. And we watched as they exploded the missile dump. And I've never seen anything like it, in all honesty. It was, someone described it as a firework display, but what you saw were projectiles erupting into the air, mainly because they hadn't packed enough explosives into the shipping container. So some of the missiles actually went off. So when you see this explosion, you see the bits of the rocket just being thrown into the air, and debris landing everywhere, fire. And it's been explained to me by the IDF while we were there that their mission is essentially fourfold. They want to expose the tunnel network that Hamas has created, and they want to destroy that tunnel network. They want to collect intelligence, which is why they're going from house to house. So they're looking for information that explains how they managed to launch their attack on October the 7th. They also want to cut the head off the snake of Hamas. They want to remove the leadership. And they also want to obviously rescue the hostages that have been captured by Hamas. So as they're going through, they're identifying the weaponry, they're finding munitions all over the place every single day. And the team that we were with, their job was essentially to destroy it, disarm it. And by doing that, you weaken Hamas, you weaken their ability to strike, and you essentially cut the head off the snake.
And tell us about the chilling lair that you were taken into, and what the items that were found there. That seems pretty terrifying.
Yeah, so after watching the explosion, missile dump being blown up, we were taken back on the tank and we went further into Gaza itself, into northern Gaza. We were approximately about 2 miles away from Gaza City itself, which has seen the most intense fighting in the last few days. And we were led off the tank into what used to be a residential street. You couldn't describe it like it anymore because it's been utterly destroyed. We're talking like shells of buildings, no outside exterior walls left. You can see in, you can see that people lived there. You can see couches, sofas, what have you. And we were taken to an apartment block and to a flat that I think quite opulent. And it was the home of a battalion commander for Hamas. And we were led in. The front door had been blown off, I presume from one of the airstrikes. There was debris absolutely everywhere, as there is just across this barren landscape. And we were led in, and we were told that this was the home of a battalion leader. They know that this was a battalion leader because they found his epaulets in the property. They also found a bomb-making room at the back of the flat. which is only a few feet away from where the children were sleeping in a bedroom. So the extraordinary scene, if you can picture it, is in one room, the children are sleeping on, you know, they've got pajamas on the floor that we could see with Fireman Sam on. There's a toy ride-along car, and there are stickers of Real Madrid players and of Lionel Messi, just children's bedroom. But then just a few feet away in a back room, they were making bombs, and laid out in front of us were hand grenades, RPGs, which are rocket-propelled grenades, military uniforms, walkie-talkies. There were maps. Most chillingly of all, though, is that there was a very crude, school-like, homework-like 3D model, and that they strongly believe was one of the kibbutzes that they targeted. So this operation, if you want to call it that, this horrific attack that they launched, was in the planning for, they think, up to 2 years. And the detail that they went into was to create these 3D models so that they could identify how best to go through their slaughter. I mean, it's an extraordinary sight. And like I say, extraordinarily chilling in the same way. And so you've got these 3D models, you've got the maps, this huge amount of intelligence for the Israelis. It's, you know, for them, this is piecing the jigsaw together. They're trying to understand how this happened. It's very important that they collect all the intelligence, because they can start then dismantling Hamas better. So we then, you know, you look on the ground and there's TNT, there's plastic explosives, there's fuses, there's, you know, a huge amount of weaponry. And a lot of it is homemade. We're talking the stuff that they used on October the 7th, 80% of it was homemade. And what they do is they place themselves, this is what the Israelis say, they place themselves within residential communities. So you look out through these walls that have been removed from the airstrikes, and you can see that people lived here, people walked the streets, and in their midst were Hamas terrorists. And it's essentially the perfect cover. They used the residential streets and the civilians nearby as human shields, so that they could conduct and carry out the plan for October the 7th.
The Sun's Paul Sims there, speaking about his day embedded with IDF troops in Gaza. Well, how is Israel's operation to wipe out the Hamas terror group progressing? And with claims from the Palestinian Authority that it could be ready to assume responsibilities in Gaza, what will happen when Israel decides its military mission has been successful? Earlier, I spoke with Ambassador Mark Regev, a senior advisor to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, to get an insight into the government's latest thinking.
We're making good progress, but we're not there yet. The goal of our operation is to dismantle Hamas's military machine and to dismantle in parallel its political structure in Gaza that allows it to rule the Gaza Strip. So our goals are expansive. Our goals will take time to implement. This won't be over soon. For some of our critics, whatever we do will be insufficient. But let's just go through what has been done. For over 3 weeks now, we've been suggesting, urging the people of northern Gaza to move out of the areas in northern Gaza where we expected, and there is today, heavy fighting. We didn't want to see civilians caught up in the crossfire, and therefore we were urging them to relocate south for the duration of the conflict. They have done so in their hundreds of thousands. Over 800,000 have moved south, and that's good. Get them out of harm's way. We don't want to see them caught up in the crossfire between the Israeli Defense Forces and the Hamas terrorists. Hamas, on the other hand, has been saying the opposite. They've been saying, don't go, stay, become martyrs for our crazy cause. They've also not just done that in words, but they've put up physical roadblocks and at gunpoint prevented people from fleeing. That just shows the difference, I think, between Israel and Hamas on these issues. It's almost as if Israel cares much more about the fate of Gaza civilians than does Hamas, who's willing to have them all die. You know, in normal countries like Britain, Israel, the job of the military is to protect the civilians. Hamas inverts that. For Hamas, the job of the civilians is to protect their terrorist machine, and they do so ruthlessly. In the last few days, when the fighting has become very intensive in Gaza City, we've nonetheless allowed a humanitarian corridor to allow people who want to leave to leave. And you saw the pictures, I'm sure, from yesterday, where we saw people leaving the city. It's actually interesting that there are still people there who want to leave, who couldn't leave. And I think maybe that's a part of the success of our operation, that we are destroying Hamas's political control. And as a result, people who maybe were prevented from leaving in the past are now leaving today. That's a good thing.
Do you sense that there is a tide of change in Gaza amongst its civilian population, that they are then turning against Hamas and some of that fear may be lifting?
Maybe, but there's Hamas still has control. I mean, you'll notice that in all the interviews given by people in Gaza, not one will criticize Hamas. And that's because, of course, Gaza is not a democracy. Gaza is run by an authoritarian, ruthless terrorist group. And we saw what sort of barbarity it can mete out on October 7th when they butchered our people. So the people of Gaza know the brutality that Hamas is capable of, and they're very careful. I mean, I haven't seen a single interview of someone in Gaza, and a lot of people have been interviewed, and none of them will mention Hamas or criticize Hamas. It's the same with the pictures coming out of Gaza. They have the ability to control the message, because a Gazan photographer who takes a picture that's not to Hamas's liking will face retribution. But I think as this goes on, we'll see Hamas's control over the population diminish until it ends, and that'll be a good thing. I mean, ultimately, Hamas has been ruling the Gaza Strip for 16 years, and what have they got to show for it? What have the people of Gaza got from them? Poverty, bloodshed, pain, suffering. I mean, Hamas's road is literally a dead end, and when this is over and Hamas is eliminated and there's a new leadership in the Gaza Strip, I mean, obviously that's good for my country. My people in southern Israel will no longer have to live in fear of terrorists crossing the border in the middle of the night and butchering their children. But the people of Gaza will ultimately maybe have a hope for a better future, because they'll have a government that will maybe, hopefully, worry about their well-being more than Hamas does.
It's obviously a battle on the ground, but there's also a PR war that's going on with propaganda from Hamas at every opportunity. They've come out with a death toll figure, the Gaza Health Ministry, which is run by Hamas, of 10,000. What do you know to be the truth of that figure? And of the figure, what do you know in terms of combatants versus civilians?
So I have to tell you that we don't know what we don't know. We just recently revised the number of dead Israelis from the October 7th attack, because you're always getting new information. And these things, of course, are fluid. As you learn something more, you find out this person was taken hostage and not killed, and so forth and so on. We still have in Israel a large amount of bodies that remain unidentified because they were burned so badly. We had to call in archaeologists to help us identify some of these people. Terrible, terrible sights. But in Gaza, there are no such qualms. The Hamas-controlled, as you said correctly, the Hamas-controlled Ministry of Health puts out its numbers, and they have no problem about, they're very sure of their numbers. They want you to believe their numbers, and it's clear that they have an interest to exaggerate, and they have an interest to only talk about civilians, that have you believe that amongst the number of casualties in Gaza, they're all civilians. And that is reinforced by their control over the visual image. We haven't seen in Western media a single picture of an injured or dead Hamas fighter in Gaza, only of innocent civilians. They're the pictures they want you to see. Now, to the second part of your question, which is about, how many people have we killed and so forth. Once again, we can only give you rough estimates, but I can tell you this. There were similar conflicts that Britain was involved in. There was the fight against ISIS in Mosul. There was also the fight in Fallujah, similar in that they were you had a terrorist group. In the Iraqi case, it was ISIS, but a terrorist group that had taken control of a built-up urban area. And in both those fights, justified fights, it was necessary to defeat ISIS and destroy their control of those cities. But in the framework of those conflicts, there were also civilians who were killed, who were caught up in the crossfire. And I think Israel is doing, I don't want to say a better job, but we're at least doing, I think we've gone on a number of steps, giving people the time to leave, making a maximum effort to distinguish between combatants and non-combatants, between the terrorists and the civilians. I think we're doing almost an unprecedented job in trying to safeguard civilians. But let's remember the bottom line. ISIS had the civilian population of Fallujah and Mosul, and they kept them as human shields. And the West nevertheless decided ISIS could not have immunity. Despite the tragic death of civilians, we cannot allow ISIS to have immunity. Well, it's the same with Hamas. Every loss of civilian life is a tragedy, but we can't allow Hamas to have immunity. Giving Hamas immunity means Hamas will stay alive. It will rest, regroup, re-energize, and attack us again. And that's just a recipe for more violence and bloodshed further down the line. We've got to finish the job now.
How confident are you that that message is getting through, and the double standard that's often applied to Israel ebbs away? Are you feeling that there has been a sea change in any attitudes?
Well, with some people I'll never convince, yes, but I have to tell you that we've seen an important change in the elite opinion in governments across the Western world, whether it's President Biden in in the United States, or Rishi Sunak in the United Kingdom, whether it's leadership across Europe. We've seen people endorse what we're saying, which is that Hamas must be dismantled, that we cannot have this terror enclave on our southern border, that Israel will and must, has a duty to defend its people, an obligation to protect its people, and to act against this terrible terrorist organization. I want to stress something. There were a story today in the New York Times. The Hamas people talk about their desire for permanent war against Israel. The deputy leader of Hamas said a few days ago to a Lebanese television station, he said they would do October 7th again and again and again. There's no ceasefire with these people. These people are ruthless, brutal killers. And just as there wasn't a ceasefire with Al-Qaeda or with ISIS, there can't be a ceasefire with Hamas. There's no substitute for victory, and I am sure victory will come.
And when that victory comes, how confident are you that we can see the return of the hostages that were taken on October 7th?
So I can't be 100% confident, because we know who we're dealing with. We're dealing with a brutal, ruthless terror organization that has no qualms at all about killing innocent people. And so I can't be 100% confident we'll see all the 240 hostages alive. That's a sad reality, and it must be remembered, of the 240 hostages, there are 30 children, of them babies and infants. I mean, what sort of warped minds take babies hostage, take infants hostage? They are deprived, Hamas, and they have to be called for what they are. Who takes babies and children hostage? It's crazy. So we have no illusions about who they are and what they're capable of. But what I can say is this. We believe that by beefing up the pressure on Hamas, by ratcheting up the pain that they are receiving, that's the best way to get our people out. Because Hamas aren't suddenly going to become humanitarians and release the hostages. But Hamas, if they understand that they're under massive pressure, and that massive pressure is only getting worse, then we could well see movement on the hostage issue.
Away from the hostages, a lot of the criticism heading towards Israel has been around the subject of humanitarian aid. Could you clear up how exactly aid comes into Gaza, how it has been increasing since the war, and whether you think that the world has a fair representation of what the actual aid situation is on the ground?
So I have no doubt that there is hardship in Gaza. War is always hard. And people have left their homes to avoid the fighting, and they're in temporary conditions, and it's not easy. But we've been working with the international community to create a safe zone in the southern Gaza Strip, not far from the coast. And because it's in the southern part of the Gaza Strip, it's close to the crossings with Egypt. And as a result, the aid is coming in, can go directly to them. Israel has said, we've got no problem at all with food and medicine and fresh drinking water coming in from Egypt to reach evacuated population. And because they're close to the Mediterranean coast, the French are bringing a hospital ship. Others can do the same. The Egyptians have established a field hospital on their side of the frontier for injured people. And so the idea is, in Israel's perspective, to continue unabatedly the campaign against Hamas's military machine, and at the same time, in parallel, to make a maximum effort to see humanitarian aid receive Gaza, be received by Gaza's civilians.
And how much of a misunderstanding do you think there is in terms of what Israel provides typically to Gaza in a time where there isn't a war going on? I believe it's a certain percentage that Israel supplies in terms of water, but I think maybe there's some confusion that Israel is responsible for a lot more typically.
So you're right. I mean, Israel left the Gaza Strip in 2005. We took down all the settlements. The settlers who didn't want to agree, we forced them to leave. The police came and took them out, and we pulled back behind the 1967 line, the armistice line, which for the international community is the recognized border. And there's no reason at all for this conflict between Israel and Gaza. None whatsoever. It's only because of Hamas. We should have a good, peaceful relationship with the people of Gaza. But once again, Hamas is against that, is opposed to any sort of peace and so forth. After leaving Gaza, we still had relationships where people could come and work in Israel, and water and electricity was supplied and so forth. But the thinking in Israel today is now different. Following this terrible attack, the feeling is that we want to totally disengage from Gaza. The idea that people from Gaza will come and work in Israel, that's not acceptable to Israelis anymore. The attitude is, okay, maybe good fences will make good neighbors.
You say that Israel wants to disengage from Gaza, but when Hamas is taken down, presumably there will be a security system in place that involves Israel, at least for a certain period of time.
That's 100% for sure. We can't make the mistake that was made by others, that you win the war and then you lose the peace, right? We can't just sort of go in there and destroy Hamas and then leave. Well, Hamas could well come back, other terrorists, other extremist groups. So while we don't want to reoccupy Gaza, we don't want to rule Gaza, we don't want to govern the people of Gaza, we're happy for them to do that by themselves or in the framework of some sort of international agreed to mechanism, we will keep overriding security control, at least at the beginning. That doesn't have to mean a military occupation. It could be fluid. It could be Israelis going in and out to meet with problems when they arise. But the idea that Israel can just ignore what goes on in the Gaza Strip is obviously a non-starter. We would do so at our own peril. And once again, the most important thing to understand is that the Israeli public, the Israeli people, will not stand for what was the reality before October 7th. We will not stand for having a terrorist-controlled enclave on our southern border and that can launch the sort of barbaric and ferocious attacks that we saw on October 7th. That threat will be eliminated.
And as you take on Hamas, how concerned are you about the threat from Lebanon and Hezbollah? Because fighting on two fronts would complicate the situation.
It would indeed, and we want to avoid that. Our policy is deterrence in the north and victory in the south. But we have to be prepared for an escalation in the north. We don't want it, but we don't know what Hezbollah's plans are, and we have to be prepared to meet that. Now, Israel has fought two-front wars in the past. Anyone who knows the history of my country knows that we fought a two-front war in 67 and in 73. In both, we were victorious, and we can do it again. And I would say to Hezbollah, you know, Hamas took us by surprise on October 7th, and we played a terrible, horrific price in blood for our mistake, that they surprised us, that we weren't ready for them. But in the north, the Israeli army is already mobilized. Our troops are ready. We're following the situation closely. They will not surprise us. Hezbollah will not surprise us the way Hamas did. And if they start an all-out war, we will be ready to respond immediately and decisively. I hope calm minds prevail in Beirut and that Hezbollah doesn't make such a mistake. But if they do, they will pay a price that they will wish that they never had started with Israel.
And Mark, you mentioned being taken by surprise earlier. When are we likely to see an investigation about what went wrong and what enabled Hamas to carry out the attack that they did?
So you're right, and there will be such investigations. In Israel, we have a history. After there have been defense setbacks and other national security lapses and even disasters, we've had special commissions of inquiries. We've had parliamentary investigations. We did so after the 1973 war, which was also an intelligence failure, that they attacked us by surprise. It was after the 2006 war in Lebanon, where there was a feeling that we had made too many mistakes. And I'm positive we'll have some sort of investigation when this is over. And everyone, from the Prime Minister down the system, will be asked questions and will have to be held accountable for what they did and what they didn't do.
And with Iran being the puppet masters of these terror groups, is there a long-term plan for Tehran?
If we, and we will, destroy Hamas, that's one of Iran's most dangerous tentacles will have been destroyed. And it's crucial that Hamas receives a resounding defeat, yes, because then all of Iran's allies in the region, the Houthis in Yemen and the Hezbollah in Lebanon and the different groups in Iraq and Syria and the Iranians themselves, that'll be an important message that if you attack us, if your aggression, you will pay a price. And, you know, the secret thing that's not on the news so much is, but the Arab world, Arab leaderships who are talking to us directly and others who are talking to us indirectly, they tell us you have to win against Hamas decisively, because by doing so, you're fighting against the axis of terror headed by Iran, and we can't allow them to win.
Ambassador Mark Regev, who is a senior advisor to Benjamin Netanyahu. That brings an end to episode 5 of Israel's War on Terror. Please let us know in the comments if you have any questions you'd like us to answer, and we'll do our best to take them on in later episodes. You can now search for more episodes wherever you typically get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.